I was having a great deal of difficulty finding a script that I liked at all. I was reading stacks of stuff, and finally I spoke to Tracy Jacobs, who was an agent at ICM, my own agency, in fact. And I said, what have you read in the last 10 years? And this was, I suppose, 10 years ago now. What have you read in the last 10 years that you really, really like, that you think is special and hasn't been made? And she mentioned Jacob's Ladder. And I read it, and I was bowled over. And I especially liked it because it reminded me of a film I'd seen a long while ago, and I'd seen many, many times, called Incident at Owl Creek. It's a film made by Robert Enrico, a French director, and it was set in the American Civil War. And this movie, Jacob's Ladder, reminded me so much of Incident at Owl Creek. It was about a man who was found loitering near a bridge in the Civil War, in the American Civil War, and he was about to be hanged. And when they kicked away the plank, and as he dropped, and you expected him to die and his neck to be broken, he gets away. Finally, you understand at the end of the movie that in fact he didn't get away, and that everything you've seen was in the split second of him dropping. And eventually at the end of the movie he's hanged, and this really is the basis for this movie. When I was preparing the movie, I saw a great many documentaries on Vietnam. I saw there's a very good Time Life series that I saw, and it helped me a great deal with the way to shoot the Vietnam sequence. In this scene, I was trying to set up an almost lyrical, kind of peaceful sort of feeling of just total fatigue, you know, in between battles or whatever, because it would be a nice contrast for the mayhem that's about to happen.
Goddamn gooks already.
It makes me pleased to see how well Ving Rhames has done since the movie. He was wonderful in the movie about Don King. Extraordinary performance.
Hey, Professor, how many times can you shit in an hour?
And Eric LaSalle is great in the ER every week, obviously.
Why you even bother pulling him up?
Jerking off again, huh, Jake? Come over here and jerk on this. Come choke my black rooster.
A lot of this dialogue here was improvised. It wasn't actually scripted.
Please.
He's asking politely.
Ain't got a fucking tweezer, man.
Whoa! Yeah!
I was very anxious for this battle scene to have a kind of authenticity, and as I said before, I watched a great many documentaries of battles in Vietnam, and I wanted to feel like newsreel footage.
Something's wrong.
What the fuck's wrong with you?
One thing I did that was quite interesting, I think, was that I gave a stuntman the IMO, which is a very small camera, kind of a handheld clockwork camera, actually very light, and told him to run with the soldiers. He was obviously dressed as a soldier. To run with the soldiers and aim the camera at any explosions that he knew was going to happen in a certain place, so that it would have a kind of a shaky kind of documentary feeling. Like the camera movement here, when the camera is almost trying to find out where the enemy is. That explosion there was one that the stuntman filmed, you know, with the IMO. Dale Dye was the military advisor, and he put the platoon through a kind of a training exercise, if you like, for about 5 or 6 days, actually maybe more, before the movie, before we actually arrived in Puerto Rico. We shot in Puerto Rico. They were pretty ragged, and the actors were more like soldiers when we arrived. Gordon Smith, who did all of the prosthetic work on this film, I think was terrific. He'd worked on Platoon, and I think the broken limbs and shot up legs and things that you're about to see here, I think were very well done. Pretty horrifying. I think they're very real. We got a one-legged man to do that shot with the prosthetic. A truly massive explosion. Everybody was a little bit white-faced afterwards. Bits of debris were flying around. We were all kind of happy when it was over. When you see all of the debris falling from an explosion, it looks like it's bits of rock and stuff like that falling down, but it's not. It's actually cork. The man who's doing the special effects, who's rigging the explosions, uses cork, bits of cork, which obviously can't hurt anybody. When we were shooting this scene with Tim Robbins kind of wandering apprehensively through the jungle here, there was a tree that I really liked. It's coming up, a kind of very ominous looking tree with kind of vines growing up it, and I used it because I thought it kind of fitted in with the atmosphere. Yeah, this one here, I thought it looked really quite evil, this bit of tree here, and then he's bayoneted in a moment. It's interesting because you don't see blood really, except on the exit here. It was like a blood bag we had, just a plastic bag that we stabbed repeatedly to get the most, and we used the tape that had the most blood, obviously. One thing I like to do quite a lot in movies when there's a kind of a sense of unease in a scene is to dutch the camera, to angle the camera just slightly, and that shot with the beer bottle rolling around was just very slightly dutched to make you kind of feel a little uneasy. Flick the lights on and off as if the train was going over kind of points, and it cut out the electricity. It was interesting later on in this scene because it kind of added to the effect of the ominous quality of this lady. In fact, when he's talking to her, the lights cut off quite nicely.
I fell asleep.
Tim has a nice sense of humour. That's one of his nice traits, I think, is that even though he's going through nightmares here, he always has a sense of humour. When we see the prosthetic tail in a minute, it's interesting, it's kind of a little bit like a penis, really. I was anxious to keep all of these demonic elements rooted in flesh. It's interesting, because we had a kind of a device which, it was very simple really, which just straightened out this tail, or it brought it in, or it curled it up. And it worked best going outwards, but afterwards, optically, we reversed it so that the tail kind of hid itself, it kind of concealed itself, and it looked really more sinister and more kind of secretive in a way. It worked better than as if it appeared. The demonic imagery, the devil imagery, if you like, they were written in the screenplay by Bruce Rubens, really in terms of traditional kind of Judeo-Christian imagery. In other words, devils with tails and forked tongues and this sort of thing, and Hieronymus Bosch, for example, people had beaks and that sort of thing. And I was very anxious for us not to be able to laugh at it or dismiss it because of its familiarity. So in, you know, I searched around for a long, long, long while, and we agonized over this, both of us, and eventually I came up with this feeling of thalidomide imagery. In other words, imagery that were like awful kind of grotesque extensions of, but always flesh. And I thought that that would be much more frightening because it was less familiar. And so I went with that. The imagery that I used came out of Francis Bacon, the painter, for example. I also was very interested in the imagery of Joel Peter Witkin, the photographer, who did quite frightening imagery. I like this image of the bulbs shaking because I needed something to suggest that the train was coming, but at this stage he hasn't seen it. So the idea of these bulbs shaking more progressively, more violently, I thought was quite interesting. And this image is almost like an image from hell, I think. This wasn't actually a real train at this stage, it was just a dolly with a lot of lights on it, you know, to really have a blindingly brilliant light. Ellen Morozhnik, the costume designer, and Richard Dean, the makeup artist, would do Polaroids for me of different kind of makeup disguises, if you like, for the demonic images. I mean, they would give me things with gauze over faces and plastic kind of skins over faces that would look ludicrous if you looked at them for, say, 10 seconds, but when you saw them briefly for a, I don't know, a 12-frame cut or even less, they would be very frightening. And a lot of this, imagery depended on the amount of time that you saw it for whether it worked or not, really. There's a little detail there in the elevator that I liked, with the coin stuck in the window of the elevator. I'd seen this in a project somewhere on in Williamsburg, and I'd liked it and used it in the film. In fact, the apartment of Jesse and Jake was an exact copy of it, an apartment that we'd seen in a high rise in Williamsburg, but it was exactly a foot larger in each direction so that we could get the camera in.
Jake, is that you?
Because we worked it out that had we literally done the apartment in Williamsburg, we just wouldn't have been able to get far enough back with the camera. And we really used the apartment like a real apartment. We didn't really float the walls too much. I always hate doing that. I always spend more time wondering how long it's going to take to put it together. So I usually don't do it.
How come you're so late?
Bed Nash didn't show up again.
We saw Elizabeth Pena right at the beginning of the casting, and we were casting for Jesse. She was almost the first person that we saw, and we saw literally hundreds of ladies for Jesse, to play Jesse, and we never found anybody better, really. We always went back to, she was the one we had to beat. So there was a terrific chemistry, I think, between them. I'd seen Tim in Bull Durham and liked him enormously, because he really has this amazing mixture of a sweet kind of innocent quality, but he's also hilariously funny. And this is kind of a black story in a way, so I thought it was very important to have a kind of a comic release, rather a comic relief. Both.
You're up?
Fuck. What's that?
Your kid dropped it off.
Who, Jed?
No, the little one.
Eli. Why can't you remember their names?
They're weird names.
They're biblical names. They were prophets.
Well, personally, I never went for church names. What?
Where do you think Jezebel came from?
Nobody calls me that.
You're such a heathen, Jezzy. How'd I ever get involved with such a fucking ninny?
You sold your soul, remember? That's what you told me.
Yeah? For what?
A good lie.
What could I got?
The best.
I think you have a nice relationship together. There's a kind of an easy quality to it that you don't often see on film, I think. I like the way she's kind of naked and or semi-naked and doesn't have any kind of concern in front of him, which obviously she wouldn't. But you don't really see it too much in that movie. Elizabeth Peña has a nice kind of a sensuous quality, I think, which was important, really, when you think that Tim is just imagining all of this. But she also had to have a strength, a real strength, for the demonic aspect of her character to work at the end of the movie. That was very important, and we had to think ahead to that. So I think she has this range, you know.
That's a fat little thing. You have to look.
Who's this?
Sarah.
I can see what you mean.
What?
Why, you left?
What do you mean?
Jake. She looks like a real bitch.
Well, she looked good then.
Not to me.
Tim had a little bit of a problem finding the right emotional kind of depth, if you like, when he sees the picture of his dead son, Gabe. And it's interesting, he had the idea of putting a little bit of dirt on the photograph that he had to... that, in fact, was kind of ruining the picture of his son, and he had to scratch it off like that, and that helped him with the tears. And it was amazing, really. It was his thought to do that, and suddenly the scene worked. The boy, obviously, is Macaulay Culkin, who hadn't at this stage done Home Alone, who just was the most extraordinary child actor I think I've worked with. Incredible maturity ahead of his years. There's a scene at the end of the movie when he was deathly tired, and he still found what he had to.
Is this the one who died before you went to Vietnam?
Yeah, it's okay.
I do like the close-ups. I like the kind of...
Oh, God.
People kind of accuse me. You know, I have a commercial background. Years ago, I did commercials.
Surprise.
I've always loved close-ups because I think they give you a kind of a tactile feeling for the scene. I think they fill the scene out.
I don't like things that make you cry.
This is one of the first moments where you get a sense of her demonic aspect, if you like, Jezzy, when she throws all of those pictures away and they kind of burn in that incinerator as if they're burning in hell or something. See, I like the way the score came out of the bang then, the bang of the incinerator shutting, so that you don't know really quite where the sound effect ends and the music begins. I think I love scores like that, where you really don't have a sense that the music score is something going on separately, but it really integrates with the sound effects. Okay. Maurice Jarre I've worked with twice. He did Fatal Attraction with me, and And he's just a fine, fine composer of film music. We worked very closely, I think, on this film together. I've forgotten what the original tune was that Bruce wrote, but I like this one because I like when it's talking about Sonny Boy, and I thought that kind of tied in nicely with the dead Gabe, and in fact later on we see them singing the tune together. It was quite a sweet moment. Yeah, it's Reggie McFadden. He's just a very funny guy. And it's always nice to have somebody at a party or something like that, or a situation like that in the post office where they make people laugh, because all of a sudden the scene is lifted. You know, if you have a catalyst like that in a film, in a scene like that, somebody who will make the rest of them laugh or make Tim laugh.
How's it going?
Better now.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I'm gonna go home.
What's wrong?
It's one of those days. Back's killing me. I'm gonna see Louie.
Oh, no, not again. Your boss is gonna kill you.
What can you do?
Well, I miss riding home with you.
Yeah?
I was looking forward to it.
Yeah? He's even better.
That's quite a nice cut. I think that abrupt cut there going on, huh? Squeezing his back. There's a lot of cuts like that. Tom Rolfe and I worked hard on that. I think Tom Rolfe's a fine editor. Danny Aiello, if you like, is the angelic presence in the movie. He's the one that Jake can rely on. He's always there for him.
Turn on your right side.
How about the other right? I don't understand you philosophers. You got the whole world figured out, but you can't remember the difference between right and left.
What'd she say?
Well, not much. She's like you.
He had a chiropractor there on the set, telling Danny Aiello what moves to do, and so I've had quite a lot of chiropractors come up to me since the movie's come out and say, well, you've got all of that right, got that stuff right.
That's good. Now turn to your left.
Did she talk about the boys?
She said you're a son of a bitch, and she regrets the day she set eyes on.
I thought she didn't say much.
She didn't. That's about all she said. Put your hand in your hip. Take a breath. Easy. On your back. I think she still loves you.
I don't think so.
She doesn't stop talking about you. That's love, Jake. I think you should go back now.
Threw me out, remember?
Problem is, I spent 6 years getting a PhD and then went to work for the post office.
This is a nice cut coming up now, I think, going back to Vietnam.
Any other brain but yours, I'd agree. Now relax. And relax, this is going to be a little strong. Attaboy.
Apparently they used those red lights, you know, when they were looking. They always used red lights, apparently. When they were trying to find wounded men, etc.
What did you do to me?
I had to get in there. It's a deep adjustment. Rest a moment. Let it set a bit.
I had a weird flash just now.
What?
I don't know. I've been having them recently. You know, you look like an angel, Louis. Like an overgrown cherub. Anyone ever tell you that?
Yeah. You. Every time I see you.
You're a lifesaver, Louis.
I like that moment, the lifesaver line. I think it's just a moment when you get a sense that he's somebody other than what he appears to be. That he's something more than just a chiropractor. These kids were hilarious, a lot of fun to work with.
Mr. Postman, please, Mr. Postman, say, whoa, yeah, Mr. Postman,
I think it's always nice to get a feeling of humour sometimes, a sense of well-being like this, before something awful is about to happen. It kind of lulls you into a sense of well-being. It's interesting when you're cutting an action sequence like this, trying to work out how long you can believably keep him running, you know, with the car pursuing him like that. I went back and shot those guys looking out of the window three times. I just wasn't happy with the imagery, and in the end I think it worked. It was kind of a blend of a mechanical shaking, kind of a doll thing, if you like, plus real people with kind of masks. But I think that the combination finally did work, but it was very, very difficult to get it to work. As I say, I reshot it three times, I think. Just Suzanne Shepherd, I've since worked with her on Lolita. She's a fine actress.
No, he's been here for years.
Not according to my charts. Do you have an appointment?
No. Listen, I need to see him. I know where his room is. Just give me a pass. Don't be long, 10 minutes.
Our doctors are seen by appointment only.
Damn. I was in the veterans outpatient program. He knows me.
What was your name?
Singer, Jacob Singer.
I didn't even have my lunch.
And there's a nice bit of business Suzanne does there. It's great. She's looking for his file, but then she finds another file, and instead of putting it back in the filing cabinet, which would have been the obvious thing to do, she saves it for later on, as if she has to work on it. That's a real actress. That's a fabulous actress. That's somebody thinking about what they're doing. It said in the script, coming up, it said in the script that when her hat falls off, he sees horns. Now, had I literally done horns, I think, you know, like a deer's horns or something like that, it would have been hilariously funny, you know. But so again, I tried to get the horns to be kind of based in flesh or bone, if you like. So these really look like extensions of her skull almost. They look, I think, look quite real. It's interesting because they really kind of say hideous deformity first, but I think the second thought is that they do look a little bit like horns. This is kind of interesting. This is a cheat. You see him running along the corridor in the video screen, and then you'll see him in a minute now running down the same thing for real. So in other words, I cheated that. I used it twice just to pad out the sequence a little bit. I didn't have enough material, really.
Can I help you?
It's Dr. Carlson, isn't this his office?
I think you really begin to feel a sense of real sadness and affinity with the Jacob character here, really, that his world really is falling apart. Nothing is real. Nothing is as he thinks it's going to be.
I'm so sorry. Dr. Carlson died.
Died?
It was a car accident. About a month ago, just before Thanksgiving.
How did it happen?
No one really knows. They say it blew up.
Blew up? What do you mean, blew up?
I really don't know.
It's a nice music cue here.
Is there anything I can do for you? Do you want me to get you somewhere?
It's like, it's neither there nor not there. It's great, though. It's
okay.
Kind of drifts in and out. Voices in the queue.
Maybe it's the pressure, Jake. You know, the money, things like that. Or your wife.
Why do you bring her up?
Jeff Kimball really lit this scene beautifully. It's
she's always
nice,
in
that
mind.
Kind of shadowy backlight. Most cameramen would have overfilled it this side.
Maybe it's the war.
I like this thing she does with her foot in his shorts. He just happened to do it. It's a sweet thing.
How does that explain barricaded subway stations? How does it explain these fucking creatures?
Creatures? Jake, New York is filled with creatures, and lots of stations are closed.
They're like demons, Jess.
Demons? Jake, honey.
It's nice that Jess is so sweet to him here. And then the worm turns at the end. This shot of her hands, her nails going down his back, which I think suggests that she's not all she seems to be.
Jake,
I like the sound effect coming up of her fingers.
You still love me?
What?
You love me?
Again, it's the music out of that. So this is the party that was something of a nightmare. It was never enough time for anything, and I remember the state of mind I was in doing this. This is a sweet girl. She's very funny. Made me laugh a lot there. Patty Rosborough. She's a stand-up comic, actually. Hilariously funny. Again, a good person to have around, you know, at a situation like this, a party like this. I tried to spread around the kind of demonic imagery, if you like, to get him progressively more paranoid and sort of troubled.
Hey. Let me look at your hand.
No, thanks.
Go ahead, Jake. Let her do it. She's real good.
Come on. It's fine. You left-handed? Right-handed.
Right.
Give it to him.
Okay.
Hmm? Mm-hmm. You married man. Please. Oh, no. Oh, divorce. I like that. You see this here? That split?
What?
Right here?
It's a paper cut.
Ooh, a sense of humor. I love it.
Hey, Jake.
I like the way Fatha Murchison gives this scene a kind of a sort of sexy sort of quality, a sort of intimate quality that she makes it fun. You know, I never really saw it quite that way on the written page, and then you have again the kicker at the end when she says this line says you're dead. Again, a lot of that was improvised, which is nice.
You have a very strange line.
No, it's not funny. See, according to this, you're already dead. You out of here, baby.
There you do.
Just give me your blue eyes before you go. Feels so good. Wait, Jake, come here. Come on.
lots of different things here for the demonic imagery, all sorts of things. We used birds, if you can imagine. We had stuffed birds on strings that somebody was waving around that kind of work, actually, because you see them so very quickly. I was always very frightened of doing special effects stuff that involved handing a scene over and saying, well, you fill in all of the gaps. You know, I've never really wanted to do that. So in this film, everything really was done, literally everything was done at the time of the shooting. When you see this guy again, the frightening guy with the beard there, later on, when you see his close-up and his head is shaking in that kind of crazed way there, the way we did it was that we shot at 4 frames, which is 4 frames a second rather than 24 frames a second. So when you project it at 24 frames, it becomes this tormented, agonized quality, which I think works rather well. And you're not quite sure what you're looking at. Obviously, in amongst all of this is the prosthetic stuff. We had a stuntman wearing those wings. Actually, he only had one wing, but it was immensely heavy, and the poor man nearly collapsed at the end of every take. He also had a separate tail. But all of this stuff looks organic, I think, and I think it's tough to get a handle on, so it's really rather frightening. Also, what helped us a great deal here was the strobe light. Because it's flicking on and off, you get away with a lot more. And it means that and this is really important, I think, it means that the imagination is filling in a lot of the holes, and in the end, your imagination is much better, I think, than anything I can do. The thing with the horn was very, very tough. With the horn coming out of Jez's mouth, it was a combination of two. It was the real Jessie with various lengths of horn, if you like, in her mouth. And there was, and for the moment where the horn actually shoots out of the mouth, obviously we couldn't do that with her. That was a model. But again, because you see it so quickly, you get away with it.
I have never been so mortified in my whole life. What do you mean like that? I don't understand what's gotten into you, Jake. You're not acting normal. I've been with too many crazes in my life. I don't want it anymore. I'm tired of men flipping out on me. If you go crazy, Jake, you're going crazy about yourself. You understand?
His temperature is 106. And the fact that when he gets into the bath, he's burning. It's all imagery from hell.
Gone to the top.
Great.
I'm Dr. Forrest. I'm so sorry to bother you. This is Jesse Pipkin up on 14G. I just took Jake's temperature and it says 106. Could that be right? Oh my God. Oh my God. Get out of bed!
I can't. I'm freezing.
Jake, for Pete's sake, get out of bed!
What did the doctor say?
You die on the way to the hospital now. Come on. Come on. Up. Up. Hold on. Hold on. It's gonna be okay, Jake.
I like the way she pulls his shorts off then, just like he's a kid, you know? It's like the most natural thing on earth.
What's happening? I need some ice right away. He's running 106 feet, which is emergency.
It's interesting,
ice.
Those two shots when he collapses to the floor. We took a long while cutting this sequence, and I needed to get her back out of the corridor. It was taking too long in the corridor, and I realized that I could use those two shots of him collapsing to the ground as a cutaway. So we shortened the sequence that way. This is a good sequence, I think. With these rubber ice cubes being poured on him. Some were rubber, some were real, as far as I remember.
Hold her, hold her.
We used an underwater camera as well, looking up through the water in a minute. We had a kind of a tank for that. Here, that shot, for example, that quick one. There's another one coming on later. That one. His point of view of them. Now, this was a very complicated moment that we talked about forever, because this appears that everything you have seen to date that concerns Jesse has been dreamt by him in bed with his wife Sarah. But of course, after this scene, we go back to Jesse. So we kind of pull the rug out from under people there. But it's that sort of movie, I guess. And given that everything that happens after Vietnam obviously is in his head, I guess we can do it.
Telling you, Sarah, if you want fresh air, you can sleep on the fire escape, knowing that window's closed.
It's not healthy when it's closed.
Healthy? You call this healthy? I'm gonna die of pneumonia. This is healthy? The dream I was having, I was living with another woman. Yeah. You know who it was?
I don't want to know.
Jezebel from the post office. You remember her. We met her at the Christmas party that time. I was living with her. God, what a nightmare. There were all these demons, and I was on fire. I was burning from ice.
Guilty thoughts. See what happens when you cheat on me, even in your mind.
She's really good and bad.
Go to sleep.
This is Patricia Callamber, who is playing Jake's wife here.
I thought you said it was a
She's
night.
A big contrast, I think, with Jesse. This is kind of sweet quality. This is Macaulay Culkin here, who we obviously saw later in Home Alone. He's quite a lot younger here.
What was that noise?
What are you doing up?
It's cold.
Well, tell your mother.
Go back to bed, darling.
Will you talk bad?
Extraordinary actor, Macaulay. He has this knack of making everything he does charming.
Oh, Daddy.
Fine, there's a moment here when Tim sings Sonny Boy to Gabe. And before we did the scene, he said, I want to sing to him. And I thought, God, I'm not sure that's a great idea. I kind of wonder how it's going to turn out. But, you know, went along with it, and I think it turned into a sweet scene, really. I like the way the kid joins in.
Sonny boy, when I'm old and gray, dear, promise you won't stray, dear.
So it shows that you should always keep an open mind, I think, when you're shooting.
Boy.
And I always, I'll say, I'm eager to take any suggestions I can get.
5 o'clock in the morning, we'll talk about it at breakfast.
All right, but don't forget. I love you, Dad.
What is this, a convention? I love you too, Pickles. Go back to sleep.
Wait. Don't go.
I'm not going anywhere. I'm right here.
I like the scene when he is leaving Gabe, and Gabe wants him to leave the door at just the right angle.
Don't shut it. Open it a bit more.
This is something I stole from my daughter Amy, who would always say, I want it open a little bit more, a little bit more. This was a handheld shot that we did over cranked, meaning slowed down, to give it a kind of a dreamlike effect. This is the point of view, really, of Jacob in the battle, being carried wounded back to the hospital. And this next shot, when you go back to Jesse period, and when you see Jacob again in the bath, I think it's just extraordinary. I think his face is just transformed. Quite amazing. And this is the shot I was talking about. I think it's extraordinary. With Morris's music.
Lucky guy, Jake. You must have friends in high places.
That tear. Amazing for a director when an actor delivers for you like that. Just spectacular. Makes it all worth it. There's a moment here I took from a documentary that I'd seen in Vietnam when a body cover comes off. There it is on the right. I saw this in the downdraft of a helicopter. I saw that documentary and used it. And I used this shot as well from a documentary. Strange feeling, this sequence. I mean, that was the cameraman here in the basket, obviously being revolved. This is supposed to be Jake's point of view as he lies in bed, and I think probably I should have had his face first so that you understood exactly what it was. Maybe not. I'm never quite sure whether it works or not.
Gonna be all right, Jake. Oh, you're gonna be fine.
Am I home?
You're right here. Home. Doctor says you're lucky your brains didn't boil. But at night, Jake, you were screaming and kicking.
This is a nice theme of Morris's now.
Sam, close the window. Over and over. And talking to your kids. Even the dead one. Weird, huh? You know, you melted 50 pounds of ice.
It's fun when you go to Morris's house, Morris Yard's house, and he plays the theme for you, or themes that he's got on the on his piano in his living room there, and you then finally hear it in this way, the orchestra.
Doctor says you gotta rest. You see, he says you have a virus. That's what they always say when they don't know what it is. You just lie here, okay?
This is really Jake getting going further and further downhill, really becoming more and more obsessed with what's happening to him, trying to learn about demonic imagery. So Jake becoming increasingly disturbed tries to find out desperately what's wrong with him and what's happening to him. And at the end of the scene, he thinks he has the answer. During this scene, also, Jesse becomes increasingly disturbing and worrying for him. And he hallucinates.
Well, you really ought to get out.
I tried to shoot Jesse in a kind of a bizarre way. Like here, for example, that double image of her in the, at the corner of frame. I wanted to make her look just a little, here again, a little strange, tying in with this imagery that he's looking at in the books.
Well, enjoy yourself. One of us should be having a good time. Anybody in there? Anybody home?
Again, that prosthetic device of the tiny little teeth in her mouth there, you know, she put in. I think it works quite well, because again, it's very quick. Now, I think in the script it was written that they kind of, the teeth became shorter, or you saw them change. Now, I think if you saw that, it would be a little bit kind of cheap and cheerful. I think if you saw the process happen, it would be something that you've seen before. You know, those sort of morphing effects, if you like. But I think the fact that it's like, did I see that or didn't I see it, I think is, in the end, more effective.
It's Paul. Paul Groninger?
Paul Groninger.
Paul?
Paul Groninger? Jesus, how are you?
God.
Like 5 or 6 years.
Yeah, a long time.
So what's up?
Nothing much.
Yeah, well, same here.
I need to see you, Jake.
Well, I'd love to see you, man, but I've been kind of laid up. I've been sick.
I need to see you.
All right.
Something's wrong, Jake. I don't know what it is. But I can't talk to anybody about it.
This was a great old bar that we shot in. I've forgotten where it was, to be honest, Dib. But it had a pool tables upstairs and a boxing ring downstairs. And it's one of those places that there's not too many of them left, really.
Straight as I can put it. And don't tell me that I'm crazy, because I know I'm not. They're coming after me.
Who is?
They've been following me. They're coming out of the walls. trust anybody. But I gotta talk to somebody. I gotta talk to somebody. I'm gonna
fly out of my fucking mind!
Mind your business.
I don't know who they are or what they are, but they're going to get me, and I'm scared, Jake. I'm so scared, I can't do anything. I can't go to my sister's. I can't even go home. I don't know what to do.
So we understand that Paul here is going through the same symptoms that Jake is. So this is a moment of real revelation for Jake, and kind of a relief in a way to him to know that somebody else is suffering the same things that he is.
I thought I was the only one.
Yeah, me too.
I think the score is great here, half in and half out. It's kind of almost subliminal.
Look, I carry these around everywhere with me. But they don't help. Nothing helps.
This is the second appearance of Michael, who we'll see later on. Michael's the chemist.
What happened that night? What was it?
So when Paul turns the key and we understand what's going to happen, that the car's going to explode, I like this moment where the shock wave blows the coin and you extend the moment before it actually explodes. Obviously unreally, but I think it works. And you have that moment of friendship between them, which I thought was really quite moving, before Paul dies. Again, I saw documentary footage in Vietnam where somebody, I guess the co-pilot, was shot in the cockpit of the helicopter, and the blood hit the windshield. And I thought it was such a dramatic moment that I stole it for the movie. Also, I like the handheld top shot of Tim petrified on the floor of the helicopter. Again, we see Michael here, who helps him. Michael, who we find out later on is the chemist who produced this drug that the army used. I had a dummy made of Paul that was in the car when the car was burning, and you saw his hand on the steering wheel, and it was moving in a kind of agonized way, but I took it out in the end because it was really too disturbing. It was a dummy, a model, if you like, that was moved mechanically when it was in the flames, and it was really very lifelike and just horrendous to look at, so I cut it out in the end.
just want you to listen to what you say.
Did anybody see the police report? Sounds like a bomb to me.
Paper said it was electrical. It was an accident.
That's bullshit. Someone's covering something up. That was no accident. It was set, man.
Why? Paul wasn't hit by anybody in the world.
So what do you say when you're
here in this scene? Obviously, we understand that the rest of the platoon is going through the same experiences that Tim is.
He didn't know.
That Jake is in the movie.
Demons.
Demons? What the fuck are you talking about, demons?
He thought he was going to hell.
Well, why did he say that for? I mean, what would make him say that? I mean, that's strange.
What else did he say, Jake?
He was scared. He was seeing things coming out of the woodwork. They're trying to get me, he said.
Did he say what they looked like? Excuse me.
In one end and out the other, huh, George? Still a fucking spaz. Hope he can hold his dick better than he can hold his bottle. What?
It's funny, this wide shot of the building with the guys on top, I just picked up right at the end of the day. I saw the building was in silhouette, and I thought, God, that's a nice establisher that I didn't have for this scene here. And so I sent him up to the top of the building and shot it. It was actually another building. It wasn't the same building. I just grabbed it. I thought it was interesting to shoot this scene on the roof, you know, with a kind of a pigeon coop there, and thing holding a pigeon.
What makes you think the army's going to give you any answers, huh? I mean, you're going to be butting your head up against a brick wall.
We'll just have to get ourselves a lawyer.
Yeah, you should find yourself a shrink.
I thought this was a fairly interesting way to set the scene and to get a sense of the neighborhood of Williamsburg.
Carol, I'm going to need you with your pad in about 15 minutes. Well,
Jason Alexander here is playing the lawyer, Geary. And this was before, if you can believe it, before he did Seinfeld.
Listen, Mr. Geary, this is very important to us. The Army did something to us, and we've got to find out what.
The Army. What is
kind of playing a revolting guy, really, in it. In the movie, and I like the way he chews the ice. It was a nice bit of business that he picked up. Later on, he's eating the Fritos.
Am I Perry Mason?
I'll look into it.
Do you think we have a chance? I need sworn depositions from all of you. I need a list of every other member of the platoon or the survivor.
This is great.
Yeah.
Well, I'll tell you one thing. If we do find that the military is implicated in this, you all stand to make quite a bit of money. Not that I can predict anything. But class action suits of this kind have been awarded fairly generous judgments. That wouldn't be so bad, would it, Mr. Singer?
We're not in it for the money.
That's right. All right, gentlemen.
Who wants to go first?
There's a little beat here in the car, you know, where somebody's watching them, obviously. They're being watched through the windshield here, and I like, there's a shot coming up of just this cup of coffee being thrown out, and it, I think, really helps you get a sense that that guy was sitting there for an hour or so waiting for them. There's details like that, I think, that really help
Jake,
the movie.
I put a hungry man in the oven. It'll be ready in a quarter of.
Okay.
I also made you a toss salad. It's in the fridge.
Okay, sweetie.
And I got you some apple juice.
Red cheek.
I thought it was interesting having him shaving here because I wanted to play the scene after this with him half shaven. I'd never really seen that.
Oh, and your lawyer called.
When?
I thought it's kind of an interesting thing to do, really.
Why didn't you call me?
He didn't give me a chance. He hung up on me.
Kind of caught in the middle of something.
Look, Jake, don't be upset, okay? He's not taking your case.
What? What do you mean?
He said you didn't have one.
What's he talking about?
I don't know. He was very rude. He said that your friends backed out.
Oh, I don't believe this.
Oh, baby,
it's funny, those close-ups in the desk there. I mean, we spent easy half an hour arranging each drawer so that you get a flash of childbirth in America there, just bits and pieces that really kind of said the sort of person that he was or the sort of person she was. It fills out the characters. I think the close-ups are really important.
Yeah, me too. I'll see you there.
This is a good scene for Eric LaSalle, I think.
Hello. Frank, hi, it's Jake. Listen, just got a strange call from Geary. He said the guy's back down. What's he talking about?
I like the lighting in the scene that Eric LaSalle's in, this one here. When he sits down on the bed, he's just lit with a kind of a rim light around his head. When you go into close-up, you'll see it. It's just beautiful quality on his face, I think. With that dark background behind you, wait till you see his close up.
Things happen. Things happen. What does that mean?
I thought we were gonna do something, Frank.
It's nothing to do, Jake. Who's been talking to you? What's going on, Frank?
This is the shot I was talking about, that one.
I'll call the other guys. They're not interested, Jake. What do you mean they're not interested?
He came round to the front a little bit on Eric so that you could see that he was crying. You might have seen him in the other end.
Your army's hiding something from us. We gotta find out what it is.
Jake, man, I gotta go.
No, don't we?
I thought it was interesting because the scene was written just for Eric, that it was just him speaking without anybody else in the room, and I thought that I suddenly realized that Brian Tarantino and Ving Rhames were there. So I put them in, I did the cutaway of them to get even more of a feeling of conspiracy against Jacob. I think it helped get a sense that they were all in it together. Screwing him. The scene coming up is interesting. I was going to set the scene with Jason Alexander and Tim in a corridor. And I rehearsed it in the corridor, but when I realized the height difference, because Tim really is about 6'4", and Jason Alexander certainly isn't that. So when I rehearsed the scene, it was hilariously funny. I mean, the actual height difference was ridiculous. So I had to set it on the stairs here, so that Tim could go down a couple of steps lower than Jason, and it wouldn't be funny. But now that I mentioned it, maybe you'll find it funny.
I'll tell you what's wrong with me. I don't know you from Adam, right? You walk into my office with some bizarro story and demand that I check it out? All right, fine, I did. Now, I don't know what kind of a fool you take me for, but you have used and abused me, sir. I don't like it.
Used you?
That's right, I checked with the Army's Bureau of Information. You never even went to Vietnam.
What's that supposed to mean?
It means that you and your friends are wacko. You're all discharged on psychological grounds after some war games in Thailand.
War games in Thailand? Don't you see what they're doing? That's a lie. We were in Da Nang, for God's sake. You gotta believe me.
Go fuck yourself, singer.
Quite like the Dutch angle on Jason, you know, with the camera angle like that. I think that worked quite well. This is the scene where Tim is dragged off into the car here. And I always like it when you have a kind of a passerby, and I thought it was interesting the lady with the with a baby, you know, with a baby carriage, frightened for her baby there. I thought it was a nice kind of a sort of bit of business, a bit of colour, you know, that made it more real.
Mr. Singer, what an appropriate name for a man who can't keep his mouth shut.
Who are you? Who do you want?
It's quite funny. You know, we covered the car going round the corner with a couple of cameras. So it's going round the same corner maybe three times, you know, when you cut to the car. So we're that one as well, that's the same corner. So we're cheating here to try and make the sequence a little bit longer. It's interesting what you get away with there. I like the shot. There's a low angle shot looking up at the driver that we do with the IMO. It's tough to get the camera in. It's coming up here. The guy wrestling with the wheel. This one here. That's that one. Quick one. And that one again. It's very hard to get in there. The IMO's a tiny camera, so we could fit it in. Jan Saint plays the Santa Claus, robs him.
You poor, poor man.
Ho, ho, ho! Merry, merry Christmas!
It's always interesting with a sequence like this, with this guy being, Jake being pushed down the corridor, is splitting it up, you know, getting a kind of a variety in the shots, you know, getting the close up of the wheels and the.
Did you fall? He said he slipped on the pavement, may have hit his head.
Because if you have a lot of cuts, you can give the scene more urgency. If you just have wide shots or medium shots or whatever, you have no way of getting a kind of excitement to the scene.
I have my son's picture in it. Gang's picture. It's the only one I have.
I like the scene where this scene coming up now when he's being undressed. I think this works well with all of the cuts.
Doing everything we can.
Louis DiNardo, Nostrand Avenue. I'm gonna have to move you a little bit just to check for injuries.
No, don't.
This may hurt a little.
It would have been boring, the scene, I think, if one had just shot it conventionally, but shooting it with a lot of cuts like this, I think, helps a lot.
Where's Louis?
He's out of it. Let's take him down.
This, the following scene, really, this one here, is his kind of his descent into hell, if you like, and it was written really with kind of conventional sort of biblical images of hell, you know, with hell literally flames and things like that, but I thought it was more interesting to kind of base it more in reality and have the wheels of this it's almost like the infernal machine, you know, the wheels of this cart taking him over different surfaces and them getting worse and worse and worse, you know, going, and we used this an abandoned hospital in Staten Island, and it was just an awful place to be, and I think you get a sense of this. Then of course this area now is where we Brian Morris art directed it and added the limbs and the things that he that they track the cart is going over. I think this was well cast, this scene. I took a lot of trouble with the cart to get it off balance so that the wheel would shake and make that rattly noise, and would be a nice kind of punctuation to the scene. These characters are interesting as well. Nice people. They were nice people to work with. I think the special effect stuff here is really good. That this particular image was an image that I'd seen in the image of the man's masked head shaking like that was an image that I'd seen in a Joel Peter Witkin book. The bed that he's lying on here, Tim, is a striker bed, or rather a kind of adaptation of it. It's a bed that actually exists but looks very sinister. And this is where he is struggling to believe that he's alive and that he's not dead. And I think it's one of his best scenes in a movie. During this scene, when we were shooting, it was a top shot on Jake here. And when we were shooting it, I was very moved by him, and I started to cry when I was watching Tim. And I couldn't see properly, really, because of my tears. It was ironic, really. And then I looked to the camera operator, and I noticed that he was crying as well. And then I looked over to the cameraman, and he was as well. It was an extraordinary scene, really. And I remember walking across the parking lot with Tim afterwards, in total silence after this scene, and I kept on sneaking looks at him. His face was bloodshot, really, from yelling and screaming that he was alive. And it was really one of the great moments of my career, anyway. It was just an amazing feeling, and I just felt an incredible affection for him. It's one of those lucky moments that you have as a director. I was watching once a documentary years ago. I watched a documentary on BBC, and I saw in it, it was about disturbed kids, it was about retarded kids, and amongst other things, and there was a kid, a boy of, I would say, 8 or 9, and he turned and he saw that he had no eyes, and where his eyes were just skin. And it stayed with me for 30 years maybe, and I used this image of the eyeless doctor with just the skin across his eyes. I used it because I find it very, very disturbing.
You're going to have to keep your voice down.
Where's Jacob Stinger?
Chloe, I'm in here.
Jake, where are you, Jake?
Sir, can I help you, sir?
Good God, Jake, what have they done?
Can I help you, sir?
Go in there.
What is this? The Middle Ages?
Don't touch him.
Can they call this modern medicine? This is barbaric. Barbaric!
All right, just calm down.
Why don't you just burn him at the stake and put him out of his misery?
Sir, you're going to have to leave.
Stay back! Don't come near me. You understand what this is? My jail? Stay back! Take one step and I'll wrap this around your neck. Come on.
God. All right, calm down.
Back! Back!
Calm down.
Can't do that.
All right, Mitchell. Now, sir, you can't do this.
Out of the way. I'm upset. I'm really upset.
Crazy.
Watch your toes, Jake.
Well, you've done it to yourself this time, haven't you?
Am I dying, Lily? From a slip disc? That'll be a first. I was in hell. I don't want to die, Lily.
Well, I'll see what I can do about it.
It's all pain.
Straighten out your head.
Relax.
You ever read Meisterhardt?
No.
How'd you get your doctorate without reading that god? Relax. Okay, good. Now turn over gently. Right side. The other right, okay? You're a regular basket case, you know that? Eckhart saw hell, too. You know what he said? He said the only thing that burns in hell is the part of you that won't let go of your life. Your memories, your attachments. They burn them all away. But they're not punishing you, he said. They're freeing your soul. Relax. Good.
I think what Louis says now is really central to the movie. I think it's everything that the movie's about, really, this idea.
If you're frightened of dying, and you're holding on.
If you're fighting death, you're seeing devils.
You see devils tearing your life away. But
if you embrace death, they become angels. But he puts it better.
The devils are really angels, freeing you from the earth. It's just a matter of how you look at it, that's all. So don't worry, okay? Okay? Relax. And wiggle your toes. Come on. Wiggle your toes. Perfect. We got it.
We got it.
Get on your back. Come on.
Easy.
Okay. Now let's just give it a little try. I want to see if you can stand.
By myself?
You can do it. Come on. Just give it a try, Jake. Come on.
like that music cue as the box opens. This is really Jacob searching for reassurance that he exists. Funny, whenever I see those tags, you know, his army tags, I always wish they'd been aged down more. I wish I could age them down more now. We got a kid to do that letter. I think it works quite nicely. All of these flashback sequences. With Gabe, we shot right at the beginning of the. That's a nice shot, I think. We shot right at the beginning of the movie, shot them in 16mm. Quite effective, really. The total silence just before that kind of rude awakening of the car skid, I think that works well. And I think this is a nice build of suspense here with this tracking shot. Sees Gabe first here. Or he thinks he sees Gabe. This is when he sees the demon.
Worried sick. I mean, it's 2 days and you don't call me?
I was in the hospital.
Oh, Jesus, in the hospital? Jake, honey, what hospital? I called every hospital in the city.
No, don't.
What's going on?
I'm not here. You haven't seen me.
Hello?
Hello, Jacob Singer there, please.
No, I haven't seen him all night.
When do you expect him?
I don't know.
Well, could you please tell him something for me? Could you tell him that I was in Vietnam at 16?
Vietnam?
That there were a secret experiment.
What experiment?
I need to see him as soon as possible.
Hello? This is Jacob Singer.
Jacob, I was in country in 68. It was part of a chemical warfare unit out of Saigon. We conducted secret experiments for the government.
My God.
I need to see you. Are you there?
Yeah.
Do you want to know more?
Yeah, where can I meet you?
At the corner of 128th and West Side Highway in front of a coffee truck.
Okay. How will I know you?
You already know me, Jacob.
I do?
Yes. Just listen. Make sure you're not followed, okay?
All right. I knew it.
Who was that?
A chemist.
part of a chemical warfare unit out of Saigon. I knew something was going on.
Jake, please don't go.
This was the most unbearably cold day I think that I've ever shot. It was about 25 below. One's every instinct is to rush for the trailer to keep warm.
Hi, I'm Michael Newman.
Poor actors could barely speak.
I told you you'd know me. I've been tracking you for a long time. I just wish I would have spoken to you before tonight.
Why are you following me?
You're one of the survivors, Jacob. Come on, we can't talk here, it's not safe. Come on.
This was a nice location, this burnt out pier on the Hudson. It was, it was tough with a long speech like this to break it up, you know, and keep it interesting.
You ever been there, man? Well, suddenly they take me from my cell, okay? They throw me in the waiting room with, like, you know, bank teller windows. Four army colonels with medals up their asses are standing on the other side.
I tend to like to shoot these things long focus like this, rather than do it as a tracking shot that I think most would do this as.
I've been in jail for like 13 hours already. Nam couldn't be any worse.
Shows how little you knew.
Yeah, really. They had me by the balls. The next thing I know, I'm in Saigon. And I'm working in a top secret lab synthesizing mind-altering drugs. Not the streets.
I like the way he talks about the dark side just as he's going into the dark and it becomes echoey. It seemed to work quite well.
They were scared, you know. They were worried. They figured you guys were too soft, not fighting up to your potential. They wanted something to stir you up, make you mad, you know, tap into your anger. And we did it. Most powerful thing I ever saw. Even a bad trip, and believe me, I've had my share, did not compare to the fury of the ladder.
The ladder?
Yeah, that's what they called it. A fast trip straight down the ladder, right to the primal fear, right to the base anger. I'm telling you, man, it was powerful. Well, I don't need to tell you, you already know. We did experiments on jungle monkeys. It worked. They bashed each other's heads in, gouged out their eyes, chewed off their tails, and Brass loved it.
This was an incredibly tough scene for Matt Craven. I mean, he's a fine actor, and to get it to build and to find the tears, you know, when he needed to, and
took these POWs.
Huge,
you know,
huge monologue.
Kids, really, and we put them in this courtyard. And we fed them huge doses of the stuff, man. I mean, they were worse than the monkeys, you know? I didn't know men could do those things. Anyway, there was this big offensive coming up, right? Everyone knew it. Time Magazine, Huntley Brinkley.
I think going back to that wide shot just before he reveals who it was with, kind of added to the suspense of the moment. I think that was a nice beat, you know, where nothing happens and you just see the two men opposite each other.
Yours. Just an infinitesimal dose in the food supply, they said. Just to prove its effectiveness in the field. They were sure your unit would have the highest kill ratio of any in the whole goddamn offensive, and they were right, you did. Except not the way they thought.
No one can remember that night. Like it flashes, but they don't make sense. What happened? Was there an offensive?
Yeah. A couple days later, it was fierce. But you guys never saw it.
But there was an attack. There was a fight, right?
Yeah. But now with the Kong.
With who?
You killed each other.
What?
It was brother against brother. No discrimination. You tore each other to pieces.
God.
I knew it would happen.
This is the first time we see flashback.
Fucking war!
Coming up. Now, the scene originally went on further, and Michael tells Jake that he has an antidote to cure the horrors that he's been going through. And there was a scene where he is given the antidote, and he goes through this horrendous experience, a kind of an exorcism, if you like, and ostensibly at the end of this exorcism he's cured, but we find out in fact that he isn't. But we can see this in the scenes that we're going to see shortly, the scenes that have been taken out of the end of the movie. It's a complicated movie in that it deals with different time sequences. It deals with Vietnam, which that you think is in the past and in fact isn't. In fact, Vietnam is the present. You are dealing with a sequence after Vietnam when he lives with Jesse, and you think that this is a reality when in fact it's just imagined while he's dying in Vietnam. And you also have to deal with his memory of his relationship with his wife. So it's a very complicated movie. And it really felt, honestly, at the end that it was just one step too many. And I showed the movie with these additional scenes with the antidote sequence in. And the audience really, I mean, they would come out of the movie catatonic, practically. And it was only reluctantly at the end that I took it out. And I often wonder now whether I should have left it in. But I think the way that we went was the simpler way. And certainly the more comprehensible way. But in the end, I would like to show it, and people can make their mind up themselves.
Dr. Singer, it's been a long time.
Oh, Sam.
Are you all right?
Yeah, okay.
Do you want some help? I can call upstairs.
No, that's okay. Thanks, Sam.
Sarah.
Jed? Eli?
If you're frightened of dying and you're holding on, you'll see devils tearing your life away. If you've made your peace, then the devils are really angels freeing you from the earth.
It was written as, I rather rudely used to call it the Liberace version. There was a version of him going up this enormous staircase with columns and angels and clouds, and really the religious idea of what heaven is going to be like, you know. And I realized that. It was interesting. I realized that I would never really be able to give you enough angels. I would never make it magnificent enough. And it would, in the end, be just... It would be a kind of tableau. And so I thought it was more moving. Much more moving, honestly. The idea of home being heaven. Your home being heaven. And the idea of him going upstairs with... Gabe, with his son, and what I loved about it was that there's a kind of a role reversal at the end, that Gabe has a kind of maturity because he's been up there, if you like, he's been in heaven. He has a kind of maturity beyond his years, and he effectively is looking after his father. And I thought that was very moving, and I think works well in the movie. Interesting, the elder doctor was actually a real doctor in Vietnam. Somebody, we shot this in Puerto Rico, and he was a non-actor, in fact, but he...
What a hell of a fight, though.
He added something to the scene, I think.
guy's name?
Singer.
Jacobson.
We use the title at the end to suggest that Jacob Singer was right in his assumption that they'd been experimented on. And certainly I've read accounts by different journalists that experimentation with a LSD type of drug did occur, although supposedly with the Viet Cong, with apparently disastrous results. When I'm old and gray, dear, promise you won't stray, dear, for I love you so, sunny boy.